from Corrine Brown to the HRO, pension reform, and Hurricane Irma. It's our annual look back at some of the biggest local stories of the year. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and through our app. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the year on this, our final show of 2017. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, a look inside this area's enchanted Christmas village. Plus, did you follow that parody Twitter account, San Marco Train? He will chug into our studio today to say goodbye and reveal his true identity. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday. Time for our last media roundtable of the year as we welcome Andrew Pantazzi, reporter for the Florida Times-Union. Thanks for coming back again this week.
Good morning.
Charles Griggs of the Jacksonville Free Press is here.
Good morning.
Claire Goforth, editor of Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
And A.G. Gankarski, who writes for Florida Politics.
Word up.
So many stories dominated the headlines this year in Northeast Florida. Lots to choose from. Everything from pension reform for the city, that was a big deal, to the passage of an updated human rights ordinance after years of battling, to the looming prison sentence for former Congresswoman Corrine Brown. But our top story for 2017, we all decided here in the newsroom, the devastating impact of Hurricane Irma and the aftermath. More than one in three Florida households, that's 2.6 million, have applied for disaster assistance from FEMA after Irma hit back in September. That's aid to cover temporary shelter and other emergency needs. Homeowners with flood insurance are also applying for assistance. And if you didn't have flood insurance and you lived in certain neighborhoods in Jacksonville, well, you were really out of luck. Of course, this area saw historic flooding in the aftermath of the storm. Many communities across this area are still struggling to recover months later. So we begin our final roundtable of 2017 with a look back at the impact of Hurricane Irma. Let us know if you're still dealing with the aftermath. The number to join us, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect, wjct.org. Tweets to at Melissa in Jax. And you can also weigh in on Facebook. You know, Charles Griggs, just the other day I was speaking to someone who's still out of their house months after the storm and living in an apartment that they were lucky enough to find as they try to rebuild their really gutted house. So now that's true of thousands of people.
This was a really devastating storm. In fact, what people don't seem to, I mean, people don't recall is that this was the second major storm in the area in 2 years. So you had Matthew in 2016 and Irma this year. And it put a real big stress on our system for emergency response. Not only that, but the money that it takes to respond to a catastrophe like this is really it puts all these communities in the position. And the bigger conversation that needs to be had is, what does this mean long term? Will we see more of these types of storms? Will they become more frequent due to climate change or climate control issues? And so we're going to be looking at this storm for a long time to kind of study what needs to be done down the road.
That's right. And Andrew Pantazzi, as Charles pointed out, Jacksonville has been criticized for not really being prepared in terms of mitigation for flood risk and not really ready for another storm surge of this magnitude if it happens again, which we should prepare for.
Yeah, no, this is it's particularly interesting because it's something that comes up a lot at budget time. I mean, we can remember a few years back at budget time when a decision was made to take money out of storm surge to put it into firefighter promotions and raises. This is something that I think now looking forward as we look at the potential for more storm surge, it's, I think, particularly salient just because of the fact that we had two hurricanes in 2 years come toward us. And though Matthew was much lighter, we still saw in areas like McCoy's Creek, in parts of Jacksonville where it was much worse, in San Marco as well, where the storm surge. And it also just shows in Jacksonville, in a place as geographically large as this, how much where you live dictates what happens to you, because you can live in one part of the city and think, oh, see, that was another dud, that was another hurricane that didn't hit us, where if you lived in another part part of the city, the storm surge alone was completely devastating.
Yeah, Claire AG, geography still in this city is destiny, it seems so often. And as Andrew pointed out, some neighborhoods really just were so heavily impacted. San Marco, Riverside, and communities on the north side, historically black communities that don't have the proper infrastructure to deal with this type of flooding.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, for many years, Florida, Jacksonville, a lot of communities across the country have been gambling on being able to control nature and being able to rein it in, and but at the same time, gambling on the fact that we're not going to get these major storms. But as Charles said, with climate change and with sea level rise, we know that as time goes on, we're going to see more storms. We're going to see stronger storms. And as the water rises, there's a lot of properties now that will not be livable in coming years. And humanity has built close to the water, and we've built closer and closer to the ocean for that view. But if you just took a ride down to St. Augustine after the storm, as I did, and you saw houses crumbling into the ocean, people are losing everything. You know, that's something that we can expect in the future. And if we want to really be smart about this, we need to start examining what they're predicting, what the models are predicting for where the water is going to be in 30 years, and start building accordingly.
Florida's not doing that, with the exception of a few municipalities down in South Florida, AG Gankarski.
Yeah, and you know, let's look at the budget impact of the storm. You know, Irma, $85 million impact on Jacksonville. FEMA will reimburse some of that eventually. We're still waiting on Matthew money too. $45 million of damages, and we're waiting on $28 million, $27 million from the feds. Gotten a very little bit of it. You know, Jacksonville has a limited emergency reserve, you know, limited operating reserve. And, you know, we're already kind of at our lower limits in terms of what that can be statutorily. So it raises real questions of what can actually be done. I'm not hearing much in a way of a cohesive policy in terms of dealing with climate change impacts from the mayor's office. There is money towards stormwater, toward, you know, septic and all of that, but there's not really that grand strategy. And if we look at Irma itself specifically, one of the things that drove Irma was just water temperatures being warm. It was late in the year, but water temperatures were in the 80s all the way up. And Irma drew from both sides, Gulf and the Atlantic. And it was the kind of storm that illustrates what happens when these water temperatures go up just a couple of degrees. We get conditions that used to be found just in the Caribbean late in the year. And this raises existential questions. You have to wonder what policymakers are going
to
do.
That has to be the long-term strategy has to begin with acknowledgement that rising sea levels and warmer oceans are making a difference here. And, you know, we're in a position, I remember when people used to say because of our location that, you know, we were somehow protected. Yeah, protected. But that's no longer the case with two storms in a row, in 2 years in a row, two major situations where the city is and local and surrounding communities have to deal with the cost of recovering from these situations. So, you know, policymakers are going to have to address this from a long-term perspective and figure out a way to not only address the climate change piece, but to talk about what about the people in the communities and whether or not they should even be living so close to the coastal areas.
That's something else, Andrew Pentazzi, that is just really astounding to think about, that Florida continues to just build at a record pace in coastal areas, for the most part. There's not any sort of long-term thing. It's all short-term gain. No thought about the long-term repercussions to this.
Yeah. This is historic. We've always built close to coastal areas. We've always established cities close to coastal areas for historic reasons of transportation, ports.
And people like to live on the water.
And there's a lot of reasons for it. And now we're just, I think, struggling to figure out as we move on into the current crises that we're facing, where there are things like storm level rise. And you see just Miami Beach on a daily basis, regardless of storms, where water is frequently rising into the streets, what we do about it. And it's something that's not just Florida, not just America, but all across the world, nations are trying to deal with, whether it's the Netherlands or Japan. Tokyo built caverns entirely under the city just to deal with water to drain it. And one of the most massive infrastructure projects in the modern era. And yet even that is being found now to be inadequate. And so there's there's a lot of problems that are happening rapidly around the world, and we just don't know yet what the right solutions are going to be.
It's 549-2937 as we talk about the biggest stories of 2017 with our final Friday roundtable of the year. Claire Goforth, Andrew mentioned the Netherlands. Just a few weeks ago, NPR reported on how the officials down in Miami-Dade and Broward counties are on the phone regularly to the Dutch, because the Dutch, Holland, is the place in the world more than any group of people that understands how to deal with holding back water. And Miami's trying to get the Dutch to teach them what to do, because they're getting sunny day flooding all the time now. They are slowly sinking beneath the water down there.
I mean, they have two choices, I suppose, learn from the Dutch or leave Miami Beach. I don't think they want to do the second. But, you know, you look at this long term, the reality of sea level rise and climate change, we keep all saying it like it's just accepted across the country. But we all know very well that there are people, and they're not just fringe groups, that refuse to believe in the reality of climate change. People in the highest offices of our state have done things such as Rick Scott banning the use of the terms climate change, as if this is not a reality that is happening. And I mean, we have voted for these people, and the Trump administration does not seem to believe in climate change. Is that due to the influence of the oil and gas industry or various other factors? I know that he likes to talk about coal a lot, but you know, the more that we emit these greenhouse gases, the more the temperature is going to rise, the sea is going to rise, and Miami is going to flood, and other areas are going to flood. So, you know, if we as a species want to be realistic about the long-term survival of the planet and of our end of humans, then maybe we need to stop voting for people who refuse to accept these realities.
AG.
That's one read on it for sure. I want to talk about Jakarta, Indonesia. That's a place that people don't bring up, but Jakarta is rapidly sinking underwater. This points out that this is a global problem.
Yeah.
And it's not just American corporations that need to control emissions. It's also China, India, these emerging economies that we by and large import a lot of things from. They don't have the same controls over there. This is a global problem. The Paris Accord, in theory, would address some of this stuff in terms of emission control. But, you know, the reality is that, you know, we have a lot of land, a lot of high-value land that's not going to be usable in the coming years. City of Jacksonville is looking to buy out part of San Marco area, Lori Boyer's district. That's meeting with resident resistance. They don't want to move. And you're going to get that writ large in other places, and that's especially going to be true if somebody were to want to buy out some of the high-value places that flooded the worst in Jacksonville, you know, including parts of downtown, including, you know, Avondale, where these million-dollar homes on the river saw water come up. That's where you saw some of those rescues during Hurricane Irma. There's going to be a cultural shift in these issues. Is government going to lead or follow?
I do think, to AG's point, something that was interesting about, at least in Jacksonville, with the hurricanes that hit, is there were really two communities that were primarily hit in Jacksonville. And then there were plenty more in Clay County and in the other areas. But in Jacksonville, you had the poorest communities along McCoy's Creek, but then you also had the wealthiest communities in places like Avondale or San Marco.
Mm-hmm.
And these are people who probably don't often have a common cause. To have both the wealthiest and the poorest communities both facing the same crises where water is coming up to their doorstep, I think creates an interesting, political scenario in terms of putting pressure.
I disagree with that. Because the people in McCoy's Creek and the people in Avondale don't see it as a united front. They don't see it as a cause. The Avondale people see it as an issue regarding their neighborhood. And McCoy Creek, I mean, people have said for decades, well, perhaps people shouldn't live there because it's too flood prone.
Let me just jump in and say, when you talk to, say, an insurance guy like Matt Carlucci, he's running for city council again. He came on this program and said, at this point, everywhere is a flood zone.
It is in Jacksonville.
What about that?
Yeah. That's a fallacy. I mean,
why?
Because, I mean, the flood zone maps are pretty accurate here. Mm-hmm. You know, A and B was what flooded out.
But it still impacts the rest of the entire community. Even if one area floods, it impacts the entire community.
Well, that's not what Carlucci is saying. I mean, it's not, it affects the entire community.
No, what he was saying was, in this era of weather that we're heading into, you cannot assume that the flood maps will be accurate. You have to assume that you might get flooded even if you're in an area that's not designated a flood zone.
That may well be true.
That was his point. And I hope I clarified that properly.
Nobody has mentioned the port dredging and how this may impact flooding in our community. When you displace that much silt under the river and it becomes water, that leaves a lot more water to be displaced in the event of a flood. So,
and it's not just flooding. It's also highway access, tree canopies. You know, the streets of Jacksonville were impassable in some cases because of trees. And we have a lot of trees here who have the roots come up out of the ground when we have a nice rain and some wind, and that's a problem as well. And so that's going to all have to be taken into consideration.
And here's a tweet real quickly. The number to join the show is 549-2937. Here's a tweet from Yancey. You need to follow the story of a woman in Putnam County who remains homeless post Irma. She lost everything, her whole life savings. FEMA has been unresponsive. There's been a lack of communication, and we will look into that more broadly later. She tweets, "This is shameful, America."
Yeah, that is shameful. I wanted to get back to the tree canopy issue because there's state legislation that basically is looking to allow people to cut trees. The city is fighting that. City council has a resolution saying that they don't want state legislation saying that people can come after trees. They want to protect the tree canopy and on. That's the John Crescenbeny bill. So you're getting pushback on the local level against anything to do with the tree canopy. So, you know, I mean, in the wake of the storm, it always like, we got to do something about these trees. But once you get a few months past it, it's more like, well, we got to maintain the tree canopy. Yeah. That's something we believe in culturally.
That's why it has to be a long-term comprehensive strategy for disaster recovery, and as well as you know, how we deal with flooding in this area related to climate change and rising sea levels.
Yeah, I mean, why on earth would we want to take all the shade away from Jacksonville, Florida, where the sun is incredibly strong? I mean, it's a health hazard, realistically. And trees also take a lot of CO2 out of the atmosphere.
Okay, if you're just tuning in, it's our final media roundtable of 2017 as we look back on the biggest stories of the year here in our area. And another huge local story this year, of course, the conviction and looming prison sentence for former Congresswoman Corrine Brown. Brown must report to prison on January 29th after losing several appeals. She is serving a 5-year prison sentence after being convicted on 18 federal counts of taking money that donors gave her that they thought was going to a charity. Instead, that charity was a sham, and Brown, prosecutors proved, was instead using the funds on personal expenses and lavish events. And so the sad end to a long career in politics ended with a corruption conviction. Charles Griggs, Corrine Brown appealed on a number of fronts, but as yet she has not been successful. And unless something changes, she will report to prison next month.
It appears that reporting to prison is imminent. But that doesn't mean that she's not going to continue to file her legal appeals and let the process play out. As you mentioned, this is a sad end to the tenure of a congresswoman. And she had a lot of fans and supporters in the community, as well as people, a lot of critics.
Many detractors.
Yeah,
so a polarizing figure.
Very polarizing for the way she did business around here. But in D.C., Corrine Brown served as a congressperson who was able to work within on both sides of the aisle, because she served during both terms, like when Democrats were in power and they had the majority, and when Republicans had the majority. So she was able to maneuver both sides of the aisle because of that, and was able to bring a lot of funding for projects back to Jacksonville. So it is going to be a power perspective. It's going to take a while for that seat to be filled in that manner, because you got to get up to speed, you got to earn seniority, and so it's going to be a loss from a policy perspective.
Andrew Pantazzi, the Florida Times Union, admirably fulfilled its role as a check on power in this community when it reported on the bogus charity One Door for Education. That led ultimately to this coda to her story in politics. She will now go to prison.
Yeah, my colleagues, Nate Monroe, Chris Hong, and Steve Patterson really did do an admirable job following the money, figuring out exactly what was happening, looking at official documents, even flying up to D.C. to put together how Corinne Brown and her staff had this sham nonprofit that was not actually a nonprofit at all. And not only that, was taking in lots of money from people along the political spectrum as well. It's interesting to see even the victims list, to see how many financial donors who are both Republicans and Democrats who were willing to donate on the basis of here is a respected congresswoman who says this money is going to help children. And instead it was going to buy Beyonce tickets and Jaguars box seats and other things that she was using it for as a personal slush fund. And in fact, when we look at how Judge Corrigan ruled in her sentencing, her insistent defiance, her persistence in saying that the Obama Department of Justice was racist in pursuing this case against her and speaking out did not help her case. And now that her defense on appeal is just that she did not know what was happening, that she was taken advantage of and she should not be held liable for what her chief of staff did. I think that coupled with her sort of defiant tone really hurt her ability to get a more mitigating sentence so that she could get away with whether it's just probation or anything else. And so she's going to be in federal prison while she appeals this case.
Claire. Yeah, the departure of Corinne Brown leaves a void in the local power structure. I mean, she, for many years, basically had a stranglehold on the local Democrats. Even the tiniest decisions had to be run by her. She seems to have seen
herself. Not just the Democrats.
Well, that's true. Very good point.
Plenty of powerful Republicans went to her hat in hand for things they wanted and needed.
That they did. They gave her sham charity money, and they all kissed the ring. She's left this void, and no one seems to have really rushed to fill it, which probably is for the best, because, you know, it doesn't seem fair that there should be one person that you have to get on Corrine's quick picks. Otherwise, you're not going to win soil and water, for example. I mean, she was very controlling.
AG.
AG.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, alternatively, to that, with her having that sort of power structure, you also see, I think, a limitation in Democratic politics in Jacksonville, where when you have one person who's in control, and AG can speak much more about this. AG actually covers politics. But when you have someone who controls the political structure so strongly, then it perhaps not just in terms of the effects on how much she actually weighs on voters, how effective her quick picks are, but just even candidate recruitment. Are you able to get younger Black Democrats running for office, or are they waiting until they've developed a relationship with her? Are you getting people more willing to challenge incumbents? And then ultimately the top seat held by a Democrat from here, the congressional position is held by her so strongly that when, you know, she was facing all this, all the higher ranking Democrats in the area were afraid to challenge her.
AG.
So, you know, let's look at going forward now. I mean, you've got Al Lawson in the seat. It's basically an east-west seat right now. He's a Tallahassee Democrat. He's trying in Jacksonville. You know, he's got a staffer from Jacksonville who knows local concerns. But, you know, Jacksonville Democrats will tell you he doesn't seem comfortable with his own skin when he's in this region. You got another issue with Lawson, which is, you know, Lawson isn't necessarily a congressional Black caucus Democrat the way that Corrine Brown was. You know, Corrine Brown got, you know, over a dozen letters of, you know, asking for, you know, lenient sentences from CBC members. You know, Al Lawson isn't there on CBC issues. Lawson wanted to meet with Trump. Lawson actually feels better working with Republicans like John Rutherford, also from Jacksonville, and Neil Dunn from out west. So, you know, you're seeing a radical shift. And, you know, when we look at 2018, you got to look at who from Jacksonville is going to run against Corrine Brown. Alvin Brown is the name that people keep mentioning. Alvin Brown is acting like a candidate. He's showing up everywhere, including Corrine Brown's sentencing hearings. You got Rontel Beatty, a former Corrine Brown staffer, also looking to run. You know, and that's really the issue going forward in terms of the power vacuum that was mentioned earlier. You know, is who fills it and how is it filled? And is it filled by a Jacksonville candidate an hour later? Because right now it's the Tallahassee seat.
Okay. And let's take one quick call. It's Wayne. Wayne is on the line from Jacksonville. Hi, Wayne. Go ahead. Wayne, are you there? All right, Wayne, give us a call back. It's 549-2937 to join us. And Jacksonville City Council had a couple of very heavy lifts this year. The passage of pension reform, which they did in April. Passing a half-cent sales tax to pay down hundreds of millions of dollars in pension liabilities for the city. A huge story this year. Another one that ranks as our biggest of the year. The passage of a city updated human rights ordinance. This happened on the council in February when they approved the measure 12-6 after years of debate on the issue. The controversy, of course, stemmed from including LGBT citizens in the ordinance language. That group is now protected along with other classes of people, such as senior citizens, women, the disabled, and people of color, who have long been protected from discrimination in jobs, housing, and public accommodations. Two big stories, Charles, that we followed all year.
Well, in particular, the HRO story, because the passage of that marked a new era in Jacksonville, in my opinion, because this was going on for a while. We thought we had a bill early on, then Zuri pulled it back, and then he went back for it again to try to satisfy all parties, make sure you had the votes to get it in. But at the end of the day, this piece really sort of sends a signal. This legislation sends a signal to the rest of the country that Jacksonville is trying to take steps forward. And regardless of what opponents may say, this is an important issue for business development in this community. It almost sort of puts us on the map like a winning Jaguar team, you know. So
we'll talk about that in a minute. But let's get Wayne back on the line. He's on the phone. Hi, Wayne. Can you hear me now? Wayne, you're killing me, man.
Yes,
there he is.
Hi, Wayne. Go ahead.
Hi. I believe the Rockefeller Foundation funded a resiliency officer for the city of Jacksonville, and the current administration may have canceled that position. I think that would be prudent to have close attention to resiliency in light of the storms that have hit us. We should recognize, if you cross-reference the flooding that occurred in Calgary, Alberta, that Jacksonville is a choke point for the river and has the potential, had Irma come through Tampa Bay and followed the river down north to do like a Harvey and drop all kinds of water on the St. John's, we would have seen exponentially more flooding than that which we received.
Right. Thank you for that, Wayne. We covered that here at WJCT. Other media outlets covered that. The city of Jacksonville was part of the Rockefeller Foundation's 100 Resilient Cities initiative, getting lots of money for resiliency. And Jacksonville pulled out of this program. There was some backstory to why they did it, but not a good look in the aftermath of Hurricane Irma. Claire, Andrew.
Yeah, it wasn't a good look. I mean, at the time, I guess they thought that it wouldn't matter, but then we got hit by another hurricane, and everyone's like, wait, what about the resilient cities? And, oh, no, we're not part of that anymore. You know, and it goes back to what I said earlier. You look at people who run for office, and they're catering to these very fringe elements in their base, and there are people who really don't think that this is a serious issue. Climate change, sea level rise, they are not imminent problems facing us in 10, 20 years, but indeed they are. And we need to ask ourselves, and people running for office needs to ask themselves, is it worth it long term?
And something that Charlie has talked about as well earlier, I mean, this is, again, about long term thinking. So it's not as if having this officer would have changed anything this time. It's not as if, like, places that had, you know, this funding were able to prevent flooding. But it's more about long term thinking. It's more about having someone whose job is to study the issue. And particularly if we had that person working while the flooding was occurring, who could be studying what are the ways that we can try to prevent this in the future.
Let's go to Ruth on the south side. Hi, Ruth. Good morning.
Good morning for everybody, to everybody. We have a concern in South Shores where I live, which is the District 5, Lori Boyer District. The residents here have a concern that the city wants to take over our property so that there's access to the river eventually where the district is supposed to be built. So that we feel that's like a hidden agenda, and I'm wondering if anybody can shed some light on that.
Okay, thanks for that call.
Yeah, that was actually what I was alluding to before, and the district tie-in is an interesting hidden element that nobody's talking about much. And that's another matter entirely. But yeah, I mean, when the city is seeking to, you know, eminent domain on these lands, you know, the question is, well, what's it going to be used for? And if we look at that district idea for a second, you know, that's going to be...
That's another kettle of fish.
Yeah, that's a concept that there's going to be a lot of pushback on city council. The Downtown Investment Authority and Peter Rummel, the developer, worked out a deal where basically city money would go to fund this development. And this is something that city stakeholders, the mayor, you know, Councilwoman Boyer or others are saying, well, this is something we should go to. This is something that, you know, we should take a strong look at. You know, the question that people are going to ask is, why are we spending $18 million of city money on an investment like this instead of hardening infrastructure, which is a rhetorical key? You know, as important as a district might be to a few stakeholders in the city, as many jobs as it might create in the service sector, you know, the real question is this. It's like, what are the city's priorities? And, you know, as we look for another hurricane season coming up in just months, as we wait for FEMA money, as we see places that were flooded out in unprecedented ways just months ago, we have to ask ourselves, well, is the district the right kind of investment?
I think the perplexing piece, too, as well, for many people in the area is that typically we put the burden on the developers to do all of the, you know, all of the heavy lifting. And it almost looks like to the constituents over there that that's being removed by the city in terms of potentially funding this or purchasing their property. And if someone has the wherewithal to want to do something with that property, they should also be able to stand up and purchase it as well.
You know, and Rummel also tied it up, like, for 3 years with this purchase. He's supposed to have, like, paid the money.
He's being criticized
for
that.
Yeah, and, mm-hmm. you know, he missed the economic boom. This bubble's about to pop. And, you know, this property sits here undeveloped, and, you know, what happens if we have another recession like 2008? Because that's going to happen pretty soon. And, you know, because they didn't have the capital to close the deal in a timely fashion, the taxpayers will possibly be on the hook for this, and there will be the lost opportunity cost.
Let's go to Zara on the north side. Zara, good morning.
Good morning. I just had a comment that I wanted to make, just some food for thought. And if you look at the situation with our political people who are, you know, being corrupt and doing corrupt things, I just want to say that Corrine Brown, as well as many, many others, have done the same, that and worse things. I'm not judging her because I don't know how true it is just because they say that it was proven by the prosecutors in court. And, you know, I don't know what she did. I'm not condoning it. She did do it, but she's not the first. She probably won't be the last. And people do worse things than that and don't go to prison. So we have such a double standard, and this is not about even race. It's just about status and so forth. And, you know, you got people coming out of the woodworks about sexual harassment, and these people, some get off, some don't. They just put your name out there and hope that they're, but they already made their monies and so forth, so you're not really hurting them. I think this country is kind of like bursting at the seams, and this is why a lot of countries have coups. You got to get rid of, you have to nip things in the bud, in my opinion. If you have to do like the old folks did. When you see something wrong, take care of it right then and there. Don't pat someone on the back and then let others go and then say, oh, well, this one is okay because he only did this or she only did that. If it's wrong, it's wrong. It don't matter how small it is. I tell people, sin is the same thing.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as
I hear you, Zara. I hear you. Thank you for the call. Thanks. That's Zara on the north side. Okay. So right up until the end, supporters of former Congresswoman Brown have talked like Zara and said, even if she's guilty, look at all of the other corrupt politicians in our area who are doing similar things but have not been held accountable.
Yeah, I mean, that is the sad reality. It does, to be cynical, is to say that they're all doing it and she just got caught because maybe she wasn't savvy in the way that she did it. But there is an element of unrest that the caller hit on, and you know, people...
Is this country coming apart at the seams?
There's a bit of an unraveling. I mean, we keep undermining the middle class and then wondering why people keep getting poorer and angrier. And when you watch the wealth being concentrated in such a small number of people and you look at long-term racial disparities in economics and other social areas, I mean, people see the wealth of this country going to others to small groups of people like the president and like the governor, who are very, very wealthy men, like Peter Rummel. They just want to get wealthier and wealthier and wealthier, and well, to hell with the rest of us.
I think at the you know, this country has borne you know, bear the brunt of a lot of change over time. I mean, we just think it was only, you know, 50 years ago we were going through, you know, we were kind of going through the Civil Rights Movement. We had just passed the Civil Rights Act. Now, imagine 50 years ago when trying to get to that point in our society where African Americans were seen as equal. Bam, you know. And so we're seeing now where there's a lot of struggle between the haves and the have-nots. And this will play out as well, because at some particular point, people have enough. And as long as one group decides to dominate over another group without, you know, without compassion, then that other group will figure out a way to take control and do something about it. And that, you know, this country has done that from the very beginning, whether it was the Revolutionary War, whether it was slavery, Jim Crow, civil rights. We're still going through a lot of those elements. But at the end of the day, there's really no way this can be sustained the way it is with one group of people kind of, you know, holding power over another the way this country is set up now.
There actually is a mechanism for it, and it's monetary expansion. After 2008's recession, President Bush and then President Obama expanded the money supply. What happened to that money supply?
You're talking about quantitative easing?
Yes, I'm talking about quantitative easing. There are many rounds of it. It continues to happen through the Trump administration. It's one thing Trump, Obama, and Bush all agree on. And what happens to that money? It goes up to the top 1%. What happens to millennials? Millennials are basically in a place where they're so leveraged out that they're not going to be able to buy homes. They're not going to be able to live like their parents lived.
And they're very angry at the baby boomer generation.
As they should be, because they got sold down.
And by the way, so is my group, Generation X, who always gets left out of the discussion.
I mean, the reality
is, we aren't happy about it either.
In the middle.
People are working 60 to 70 hour weeks. Just to stay afloat. What happens to quality of life there? What happens to families? You know, what happens to the structure of the community? What happens to church attendance? All these things that, you know, cultural conservatives say they want to happen. But, you know, if you're basically a slave to various banks and landowners, you don't have a quality of life at all.
Rising income inequality, people have been sounding the alarm about this for quite some time. And history does teach us that when inequality becomes too extreme, social instability virtually always follows.
Yes.
It's not a good trend.
That's why we have a police state and the biggest prison industry in the world.
Andrew.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, I think ultimately what we have in the country is at its core a spiritual problem. I mean, I think it's something that really comes to people's hearts and souls as well. I mean, I think that there's a lot going on that speaks to the need to have hope and the need to believe in something. And so people, especially when they're pressed against the wall, are putting their hope and their beliefs in a political system that ultimately is faltering.
Failing,
yeah, it's faltering and it's failing. And so I think that's just really making it worse and worse, and it's making it more tribal and less able to say, look, we can agree that here is the data, here are the facts. You know, the old Pat Moynihan quote, the old senator from New York, you know, that you can disagree on the opinions, but let's agree on the facts. And yet now we're just at the point where we don't want to acknowledge facts. We don't want to agree on anything because we want to put our hope in our savior, which is either the Republican Party or the Democratic Party or whatever, instead of saying that there are things that are spiritual problems and there are things that are we can see as civic problems that we can engage in. And I do think that there's a reckoning, but even more beyond the income inequality, even more beyond the historic wealth inequality that's happening right now, is I'm really interested to see what happens with the future of work. And I think 2018 will
just
start.
Just this morning on a Morning Edition, they did another segment on a long-running series they're doing called Robot-Proof Jobs. And in the next 20 years, many Americans will not be working in their current jobs because they simply won't exist anymore.
And I think people have a wrong view of what it means to be a millennial. I think people, when they think of millennial, think of a college-educated person who has a master's in medieval philosophy and is struggling to find a job. And I think a lot of millennials are people who don't have college degrees, maybe have gone to community college, and are struggling to find a job in a way that in past generations, without a college degree, you were still able to find a job that paid, that maybe had a pension, or if not a pension, a 401k match. Something that was able to help you to be able to step up above whatever social class you were born into. And I think now what we're seeing is that outside of getting those college degrees and going into certain types of jobs, it's very hard, and it's going to become just even harder with more automation.
Well, not only that, but the economic strategist that's got us where we are don't support the type of family structure that we're all accustomed to. We all want, two-parent household, that type of
thing. Sure. Let's go to Laura now in Julington Creek. Laura, thanks for calling. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. One of your commentators said a few moments ago that an 08-like recession is going to happen soon. And I did economic forecasting for 25 years, and it's a very difficult process, and to say definitively on the radio that we're going to have an 08-like recession soon, I think is kind of irresponsible. So that was my comment, because, you know, why A, panic people, and B, make a statement of something that might, who in the heck knows, happen as though it were fact.
Okay, thanks for the call, Laura. AG, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, sure. You know what's really irresponsible? 10 years of fiscal policy has gotten us into this mess where we've busted up. We've got equity markets that are, the price-equity ratios are way out of whack, price-earnings ratios, rather. You know, we got a situation where we're supposedly in an economic boom, yet the rural areas are basically dying. These rural towns are choking on opioids because there aren't jobs there. We've seen the devaluation of high school educations because, you know, American students are not keeping up with students around the world, not just in the first world, but places like Eastern Europe now. We are seeing a cultural malaise, and the stock market and the economic numbers don't match up with that, but the reckoning will come.
Well, I hope you're wrong, and I appreciate Laura's point. I really hope AG's wrong, but I will point out, AG's been accurate in a few predictions on this show over the years, including years ago, accurately predicting the fate of Tiger Woods. I think that was your very first appearance on this show, and nobody was happy with
He's
you
a real
that
chronic.
Day either. Yeah, people did not like you for that day. You got a lot of angry calls. But anyway, I appreciate Laura's call, and certainly none of us are economists on this show. So thanks for that call, Laura. All right. Now, Andrew said we have to have hope, right? These are dark times for some, but we've got to have hope, which is why we always close this segment with the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state this week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And only in Florida do we know how to get even with Houston. Not to take sides, since we are journalists, but did you hear that after narrowly losing to the Jaguars last week, the Houston Texans,
Jadeveon Clowney
called Blake Bortles trash. Fans decided to return the favor by sending trash cans to Clowney at NRG Stadium in Houston. It is the season of giving. The whole idea came from local PR pro Bonnie Upright. Not to take sides, but Amazon has lovely teal-colored trash cans.
None of them made in America.
The address of the stadium is 1 NRG Stadium Drive, Houston. And not to take sides, but Duval! Say it with me.
If you have an Amazon Prime account, please take advantage of your free shipping.
I'd save that money for the district.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Is a victory for Republicans a victory for the average American?
It is a victory for billionaires like Donald Trump. It's a victory for wealthy campaign contributors.
We'll talk taxes, plus what we know now about a terrifying train derailment in Washington State. The Friday News Roundup next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
I'm Ira Plato. On the next Science Friday, we still don't have answers to the basic questions. What is matter? What is space? Physicists are hot on the trail of big ideas about the universe, but they seem to be running into dead ends. Do we need new ideas? We share the thrill of the things we still don't know. Plus, urban air, it's not a walk in the park. All on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. From the State House to the Everglades to the Panhandle, Florida has a unique story.
So join us every Friday for the Florida Roundup.
And hear from newsmakers, journalists, and Floridians from all across the state.
About the issues that matter to you.
The Florida Roundup, Fridays at 1 on WJCT. Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, sad news for Twitter followers around town. The lively and hilarious parody account San Marco Train, a very snarky voice on Twitter's slow lane, well, it went off the rails Thursday. The account started a few months ago creating a mock movement to make America late again. Someone even put up mysterious signs around the San Marco train tracks with the hashtag MALA. That was the running joke behind this slow-moving train, of course. It's notorious for holding up San Marco commuters along Hendricks. And the train seemed to take particular enjoyment at taking some shots at WJCT, and me too. So, we really did start to wonder who was behind this account. Finally, the mysterious author came clean. Jack DeYoung, digital director at New Era Marketing in Jacksonville, admitted Thursday on Twitter that he was the voice behind the San Marco train. DeYoung has chugged into Studio 5 to reveal all. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me, all things considered.
So you are the creator of the San Marco train account, which was a lot of entertainment for us for the last several months. Do you live in San Marco? Is that why you decided to start doing this exercise?
I work in San Marco, and you can hear the train from our office maybe, it seems like, seven times an hour. I live in Riverside, but there have been so many instances where I was delayed getting to an important meeting by the train.
That you got mad.
I got really mad, and the impetus for starting the account was actually calling my boss, Joe Sampson, at New Era, to apologize for being late for a meeting. I said some very colorful things I can't repeat here. and he said, you should start a San Marco train Twitter account.
Oh,
and
so it's Joe's idea.
It was Joe's idea.
He gets the credit.
He should.
But you did a good job on the execution. Very funny stuff. And for some reason, you decided to start picking on us over at WJCT, which was kind of fun, I have to say. Why us?
You were one of the first people, you specifically, Melissa, that referenced the train on Twitter. At that time, It was some sort of weird little art project we had. And then
entertaining yourselves, yeah.
Right. So we get the First Lady of Jacksonville Radio acknowledged it. And it was like, now this is a thing. And I mean, I can remember pulling over to the side
That's
of the
me, you mean?
I think so.
Oh, wow.
I've heard
okay.
that. My wife says that. So
oh, well, tell her thank
she's
you.
She's always right.
good way to be, Jack. Okay.
Thank you. But yeah, I pulled over the side of the road at one point and said, called our creative director and said, we need to make a billboard with a train's face superimposed over Melissa's. And that was just started this feud. And
yeah, there were quite a few jabs that the San Marco train took on Twitter. They were really funny. And you spent a lot of time on this. You worked pretty hard on this thing.
I did. And again, it started as just something to make my wife and my coworkers laugh. And then when we had the signs, that kind of became the catalyst for this being something that people cared about and tweeted me every day.
Are people in San Marco, were they asking you, who's making those signs? What's the deal with those signs that say train, not Trump, but train, make America late again?
People were telling me that they knew who it was and it wasn't me. And I would just say,
that must have been funny.
Yeah, I was like, I'm sure they're really funny. They sound great. So that was a little frustrating.
What made you decide to finally hang it up and come clean?
I think my wife got tired of me being in the car asking, like, would the train say this? Or, like, you know, driving in the snow in Georgia and looking at my phone, and she said, like, I'm not dying because of the San Marco train. Watch the road.
Oh, so in the end, it was happy wife, happy life.
Right. And yeah. Don't get me wrong. She supported it. She was great. She came up with the Make America Late Again thing. Give her credit.
Very nice. Yeah. So. Very nice. Well, it was a lot of fun. We're sad to see it go, but you've certainly shown your creativity at your marketing firm, and I'm sure your clients will benefit from that in the future. So, Jack DeYoung, have a very Merry Christmas, and I hope I don't get caught at those train tracks again anytime soon, but I know I probably will. So, that's just part of life in Jacksonville.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you. Thanks for coming on the show. That is our show. Thanks for listening. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Pyotr Chevchik of the Jacksonville Symphony composed our show theme. If you missed anything this morning, we will rebroadcast this show tonight at 8 o'clock. And don't forget to join us at 1 o'clock this afternoon for our new show, the statewide look at news from all over Florida this week on the Florida Roundup. 1A's up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this has been First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We are taking a week off next week, but the show will be back Tuesday, January 2nd. Thanks for being with us all through the year. Have a wonderful Christmas and a happy new year. We'll see you in 2018.